everyone. Good evening and welcome along to our Immerse program for tonight. And it's the last one in our series of Ron Muick. So we've been on quite a journey with Ron. Ron Muick. We've examined such a lot of his work in detail. We've had various floor talks, films, speakers, examining every aspect of it. And tonight we're delighted to bring David Maskell to you. He's going to talk about, well, you can see what he's going to talk about, but he's going to take us on the journey, I suppose, of putting Ron Muick in context in the scheme of, you know, hyperreal sculptures in Western art. So please join me in welcoming David here tonight. He is the senior lecturer. Sorry, I should mention he is the senior art history lecturer at Victoria University, and I see some of his colleagues here in the audience and other university people, so I'm sure I've had a little glimpse of the slides and they look wonderful. So take it away, David.
Thank you. Can you all hear me all right? Yes? Okay. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to come and speak to you tonight. It's always a pleasure to come home to Christchurch, where I was born. And to talk to you tonight, well, not really about Ron Muick, but of course he is the great presence that is sitting behind all the comments that I'm going to talk about tonight. What I thought I would do is really try and give you a picture of the trajectory in history of hyperreality sculpture, which is something that we can trace right back to the earliest manifestations of art. I'm going to look really at three major ways or functions of hyperreality in sculpture. First of all, the commemorative function of sculpture in a funerary context, death masks, effigies, that sort of thing. What I call the devotional function of hyperreal sculpture in the context of religious art, particularly in the 17th century, the Baroque period. And then what I'm calling the scientific role of hyperrealism in sculpture, which really first appears in the 18th century in the Age of the Enlightenment. Now, Muick's sculptures, it seems to me, engage to a greater or lesser extent with all three of these traditional functions of hyperreality in sculpture. So from time to time, I will show you an image by Muick that's in the exhibition here, just to sort of draw a parallel. Not that I'm trying to say that he's unoriginal, because he's not. He simply has taken to, I think, a new level some of the images and ideas that I'm going to be showing to you. I thought I'd better start with a little bit of, you know, why am I interested in Muick and these hyperreal sculptures. And my first encounter with Ron Muick's work was in the Sensation Show at the Royal Academy in London in 1997, where his dead dad was shown for the first time. And if my memory is true, and it may not be, but I'm pretty sure, it was not shown on a plinth. It is in the exhibition here shown on a very low plinth. But in London, it was shown simply lying on the floor. And it had such an effect on me, partly because of the work itself, which is so evocative, but almost more than that was you could tell the people whose parents had died who came into the room, particularly if they'd had a father who had died. And the overwhelming desire to pick that sculpture up and to kind of cradle it was something that I found totally overwhelming. And when I started to think about, well, where did this come from, this extreme kind of emotional, empathetic response to this sculpture, I thought, well, it really goes back to, you know, when I was 4-year-old, when my parents took me to the Blessed Sacrament Cathedral in Barbados Street and made me kneel in front of one of these painted plaster statues. Now, this is not the one that I was forced to kneel in front of. That one, interestingly, was taken out of the cathedral in the post-Vatican II reforms, painted white, and now ornaments a garden of a parish church in Brindwa, where it's become a piece of decorative garden sculpture, and totally disempowered from what it was when I confronted it as a four-year-old. But here we have in Wellington and St Mary of the Angels examples of this type of realist painted plaster statuary that, as you can see, has elicited very physical responses from viewers over the years. It's probably about 1920, but it's from a mold that was made in the 1870s in either Lyon or Paris. It's a style that's referred to as the Saint-Sulpice style. It was the workshops around the great Church of Saint-Sulpice that has unfortunately become famous because of the Da Vinci Code in Paris, where these plaster, highly decorative, painted plaster, realist plaster statues were produced in vast numbers to be sent to parish churches throughout France, but also to all of the Catholic countries where French missions were sent. So this is a sort of late version, if you like, of that phenomenon. They were produced in the 1870s and 1880s to answer a kind of groundswell of popular devotional kind of, you know, vigor that took place in the French Catholic Church of the 16th century, and that was then exported to all parts of the rest of the world. Now, not all of these images or statues are quite so arresting. Some of them have this very sweet style. This is a detail of the figure of St. Francis, looking really sort of like a 1920s, sort of movie heartthrob, with these very, very feminine painted lips. But these were the statues that had an enormous effect on me that I didn't really recognize at the time. It's only subsequently that I come to realize that this was really my first encounter with art. Of course, I never thought of it as art at the time. So that made me start to think about, well, where did this come from? Where did this, why was this hyperrealism so affecting? And you can go right back to the ancient world, where we have accounts of death masks, highly painted death masks of famous people being made. And what survives today are these. They are sculpture, actually, even though they look flat. They are three-dimensional. They were used as kind of stand-ins for the deceased on Egyptian mummies that were from the period of Roman occupation of Egypt, so from the first century BC AD. And they merged the Egyptian tradition of mummification with a Roman tradition of realistic portraiture. And they were painted in a technique that we call encaustic, where the pigments are mixed with wax in order to bind them. And this notion of wax, which of course is a very malleable material that can take the imprint of anything against which it is placed, was of course very much part of the realism that these images were intended to evoke. They were, of course, intended to give the impression that the deceased was still alive and that they would have eternal life. Now, that kind of commemorative desire for the continuation of life is something that, of course, feeds right into the Christian tradition. It's come from the Roman tradition of this type of sculpture. This is in marble, but in fact what it is a permanent version in marble of what would have been a wax funerary effigy, in this case of a husband and wife, that would have been displayed at their funeral, only for the period of the actual funeral, and then would either be stored in the house or simply allowed to be burned with the bodies at the time of the cremation. So this marble version is a permanent record of that wax effigy. There are famous stories, of course, of the use of these effigies in Roman burial rites, perhaps most famously Julius Caesar's funeral, where a full-scale wax and wooden effigy with the 23 stab wounds that he received at the time of his assassination was actually placed on a dais on top of his funeral pyre and on a mechanism that rotated so that the assembled crowds could see the 23 stab wounds. So that's the tradition that this very realistic image comes from. Now, the other thing that you need to remember about this is that originally it would have been painted in very naturalistic colours. What's happened subsequently, particularly since the 18th century, is that our neoclassical taste for uncoloured sculpture, pale marble sculpture, has prevailed, and in fact many of these antique sculptures were deliberately, the colour was deliberately removed from them because they didn't conform to 18th century neoclassical taste. This tradition was revived in the Renaissance period, no surprises really. This is a wonderful example of it, transplanted into a Christian context. Here we have a view of Guido Mazzoni's extraordinary terracotta group, full-scale lamentation from the late 15th century, in which the Mary Magdalene, Joseph of Arimathea, St. John are all there portrayed in full-scale terracotta, lamenting the dead body of Christ. And of course, I can't help think of, the dead dad in that context. Sorry, I thought I had an image of it there. But I'm sure you're familiar with it. Now, once again, you've got to remember that this terracotta would have been painted naturalistic colours, which would have given it an even more emphatic realism. Here we have a detail of the head of Joseph of Arimathea, which is in fact a portrait of the patron, Alfonso of Aragon. So, and it's based on a wax impression of his face. So we have a kind of double realism here. The realism of the group itself, and then on top of that, the realism of the portraiture, which once it was highly painted, would have given an extraordinary effect. Now, I'm sure most of you have not heard of this name, Guido Mazzoni. I mean, Vasari talks about him in his Lives of the Artists as a great sculptor. In the same breath, he talks about Verrocchio and Donatello, names that I'm sure are familiar to you. All of these artists of the Renaissance worked in this very hyper-realistic medium of either terracotta or wax. But subsequently, those media have come to be considered less important, less artistic, than the more permanent materials like bronze and marble. So it's a kind of a change in taste which has led to a kind of amnesia about this type of sculpture. And when I show you something like that, this is the effect that a highly painted terracotta work by Mazzoni would have had. And in this case, it's not a work to be seen within a religious context. It's simply a head of an old man. A typically Renaissance interest in representing the inner workings of the human psyche, as expressed through external facial features. And I can't help but think of the two women, that extraordinary group in the exhibition. The same kind of fascination with an awareness of age, an awareness of the passage of time. Now, I move now to what I'm calling really the sort of central period of the devotional function of hyperrealism, not only in sculpture, but also in painting. And there's one artist above all who is the great initiator of this realism, and that is, of course, Caravaggio. And I'm showing you here his painting, The Doubting Thomas, which, when it was painted, I think must have caused an absolute sensation, partly because of the way it was actually painted. Instead of doing a whole series of drawings, preparatory drawings, idealizing the figure, he took models off the street into his studio, lit them artificially, and painted what he saw. And the effect of that almost cinematic realism, of course it's unfair to make that comparison, cinema hadn't been invented, but Caravaggio's paintings do have this extraordinarily cinematic quality, the way that he focuses on the central figures. So it's like a close-up in a movie. The way that that finger of St. Thomas pokes into the flesh of Christ, lifting the skin slightly. Although it is a painting, of course, we are encouraged by this realism to ourselves want to poke our finger into the picture. And of course, what would happen is all we would do, is apart from be tackled by a guard, is to feel a flat surface, such as the imitative power of the illusion. And of course, I can't help think of the little, this gorgeous little statue in the exhibition of this boy who is recognizing that he's been stabbed. But of course, Muick is an artist who knows his art history. He has the stab wound exactly in the place on the left side, the right side of the body, that it appears in every representation of the resurrected Christ. And he's making an obvious comparison to make us think about that tradition. In this case, Christ has been replaced with a black boy, a street kid, who's been a victim of street violence. In Spain, in particular, the tradition of hyperrealism in painting and sculpture reaches its absolute peak, I think. And that is because, of course, of the deeply religious nature of Spanish culture in the 17th century, you could even say even today. This artist, Francisco Zurbarán, came to prominence with this work, a painted crucifix, not a crucifixion, it's a non-narrative representation of the crucified Christ that was hung behind a grill in a chapel in Seville. And people who didn't realize that it was a painting thought it was a piece of sculpture, like this work by Zurbarán's contemporary, Juan de Meza, of Christ Crucified, painted wood in this case. Now, I think you can get a sense of that illusionism in the Zurbarán. Zurbarán himself, we know, painted crucifixes. The crucifix would be made by a woodcarver and then handed over to a painter who was who had graduated from the guild system with the right and, in fact, the monopoly to paint the sculpture in very realistic manner. And Zurbarán did that. But here he's showing that painting itself can do something that, well, it can imitate sculpture, shall we say. And here we have this kind of famous playing out of the Renaissance debate between which was the greater art form, painting or sculpture. Leonardo da Vinci famously argued it was painting. Michelangelo famously argued it was sculpture. And that debate was fired the imagination of artists for many centuries to come. There you can see, I think, what Zurbaran is attempting to do. And here, even more so, the one on the left is a sculpture, the one on the right is a painting. But it takes you a bit of time to actually work out which is which. This pair of pictures, or pair of images of the sculpture and the painting was famously shown side by side in an exhibition in London a few years ago called The Sacred Made Real, which was a whole exhibition about the devotional imagery of 17th century Spain in both painting and sculpture. Alfonso Cano is probably better known. I mean, he may not be a household name, but he's certainly a name in the history of Spanish painting of the 17th century. What we didn't know until this exhibition of only a few years ago was that he was also a sculptor and painted these realistic heads. This is St. John of God. And what he's doing not only is carving the work and painting it, but also adding additional elements such as glass for the eyes. And this then gets taken to a greater extent with the addition of actual human hair for the eyelashes, bone and horn for the teeth and the fingernails. I'll show you some examples in a moment, which provides a fascinating parallel to what Muick is doing with all these different simulated techniques of real human flesh, bone, etc. That detail gives you a sense of the fineness of the painting, where the sort of 6 o'clock shadow is implied by the use of smudged paint on the surface of the face. And of course, the more gruesome, the more emotional, the more affecting the subject, the greater the realism. So the most extreme examples that one can find in this period are images of the crucified Christ or the Christ who has been scourged, shown to the people. This one, a half-length figure of the Man of Sorrows, in which the welts of the scourging are painted on the body itself, the eyes are glass, the eyelashes are human hair, the teeth are made of bone or ivory, even the fingernails are made of bone. Now, this type of sculpture required a multiple number of craftsmen. The wood carver, the person who worked the bone, the person who worked the ivory, and then it would all have to be brought together by a group of artists. This particular work was made for a monastery, as many of these were, of Carmelites, discalced Carmelites. They didn't wear shoes. That's what discalced means. They were an enclosed order, and they spent their time meditating on the Passion of Christ, and they had this sculpture as the focus of their devotions. And it's no wonder, perhaps, that these individuals had hallucinatory episodes where they believed, or in fact it occurred, that they received some of the wounds, the stigmata, that Christ had received. It was a psychosomatic reaction to this kind of intense devotional experience of these hyperreal sculptures. Not the sort of thing I would recommend. Gregorio Fernandez's Dead Christ is perhaps the most extreme example that I know of this type of devotional, macabre almost. I mean, it has a macabre quality, a kind of glorification of the violence afflicted to the body of Christ. And of course, it's not the same as Dead Dad, which is an incredibly peaceful image. This is, you know, a figure who is at rest. There's no, it doesn't have the same kind of notion of references to the afterlife necessarily. It's a figure that seems to be totally self-contained. It doesn't require the emotional involvement of the viewer, although it elicits that emotional involvement. It doesn't require it in the way that this does. And you can see that it's deliberately been placed on this almost sort of funerary shroud in this rather contorted way. This is not a figure at peace. There's no question, unlike the Dead Dad. In fact, is the figure dead? We assume it's dead, but the eyes are still open. So there is a deliberate kind of racking up of the emotional content of the work to elicit the most extreme emotional response from the viewer, which I don't think is nearly the same as with Newark. Not all of these Spanish sculptures are quite so gruesome. Some are very affecting. This image by Pedro Nemena of the Magdalene, the penitent Magdalene, who, having eschewed her worldliness, goes out into the desert and meditates on the sacrificial image of Christ in the form of a crucifix. Totally lets herself go, if you like. You know, her hair grows extremely long. She doesn't worry about eating. She is totally consumed with a kind of devotional concentration on the figure of the crucified Christ. And we get something, I think, of that in this angle shot. It's extraordinarily affecting image. Now, of course, this was made for a monastery for women. So the image was deliberately marketed at a female audience. And clearly it was intended to elicit an extremely personal and emotional response. But we also find this happening outside Spain in the 17th century, and not in wood this time, but in permanent materials. This is the famous statue of St. Cecilia in Rome by Stefano Maderno. It's a very, very unusual statue of marble placed in an altar, on the high altar of the church. And the pose of the figure is completely unique. There's no antique precedent or model for this pose, as there were with many other post-antique sculptures. The pose apparently is a record of how the body of St. Cecilia was found when her tomb was opened in the catacombs in the late 16th century, at which Stefano Maderno was present. So now this St. Cecilia, of course, was a 2nd century Roman martyr. whose body apparently had survived miraculously undecomposed until the end of the 16th century. The artist Stefano Modena was present when her tomb was opened, and this apparently was the pose that the cadaver was found in. Her head, you can see here the wound inflicted by the swordsman who finally killed her after gruesome torture that she apparently experienced. Now, this type of sculpture, I mean, it's not in quite the same league as the painted sculpture that I've just shown you. I don't think that looking at this we would necessarily be fooled into believing that this was an actual body. The very fact that it's white marble immediately makes us alert to the fact that it's a sculpture. But the extraordinary realism of the pose, the way in which you confront it in the church, where the viewer's viewing position is just slightly below that of the sculpture, so you are looking up at it as you see it there, was all arranged by the sculptor in order for it to have a very affecting impact on the viewer. Perhaps the most famous of all the 17th century Baroque sculptors who took the realism of Renaissance sculpture to an entirely new level is Gian Lorenzo Bernini, and I'm sure you're familiar with a number of his statues. I was in the exhibitions this afternoon. I was looking at the image of the woman in the bed, and her fingers of her left hand imprint into the skin of her face. And there's a famous statue by Bernini of Pluto abducting Proserpine, in which the fingers of Pluto press into the flesh of her thigh, that everyone marveled at. How could marble, this hard, cold, unyielding material, possibly be subjected to that degree of illusionism? And the patron of that sculpture was the man we see here, Cardinal Scipione Borghese, who was the patron of also the David by Bernini and the famous Apollo and Daphne. And this close-up of the portrait, I think, shows you some of the techniques that Bernini is using to convey that extraordinary immediacy of, you know, the talking lifelike presence of the cardinal, almost as if we're present at a conversation. You can see what he does. He incises the irises. Unlike antique portrait sculpture, where the eyes were completely flat, this is something that Bernini, he didn't invent it, but he was certainly brought it to a perfection. And then you can see that he's just added a little bit of colour in those pupils, so that you get the impression of a kind of a visage that is alive and able to speak. And of course, I can't help but think of the extraordinary realism of Muick here. Muick takes Bernini's idea and kind of blows it out of the water with this detail of the mask, where every hair follicle is depicted and rendered with extraordinary realism. It's unnerving. I mean, I was in the exhibition today, and, you know, the poor guards were having to stop people all the time touching. You know, this overwhelming desire to touch, to somehow to confirm your suspicion that this is actually real. And of course, you know, if you do touch it, the illusion is instantly broken. Perhaps the most extreme example I can think of this type of Baroque illusionistic sculpture using permanent materials, in this case different coloured marbles and bronze, is this remarkable late Baroque, early 18th century, funerary effigy of a young saint, Baroque saint, Saint Stanislaus Kostka, in a church in Rome. And the body has been sculpted in black marble, the head, hands and feet in white Carrara marble, the beard is jasper, and then jasper also for the cascading canopy, if you like, under the bed, and then bronze for the braiding at the bottom of the fabric. This sculpture continues today to attract pilgrims. And the last time I saw it, someone had left a bunch of flowers in the hands of the figure. And you can see the remnants of that there. This so affecting is this image, because it's unlike painting, which can, in the hands of a great realist like Caravaggio, elicit a very physical response. Sculpture exists in three dimensions and is experienced in three dimensions. And one of the things that I found fascinating today was not just looking at the Muecks themselves, but looking at people's reaction to the Muecks. That was almost more interesting in a way. And that's precisely what Muecks wants. The empathy that is expressed by visitors to this exhibition is unlike anything I've ever experienced. And that's a real testimony to the artistic power of his work. Now, there is a whole tradition of realism in sculpture which has been sort of written out of the history of art. And that is the story of wax sculpture. And I'm just showing you here a very rare survivor of this type of sculpture. It's a wax portrait of Louis XIV of France by Antoine Benoit, who was a member of the Royal Academy. He was made a nobleman by the king. He was given the monopoly of exhibiting wax portraits of the king and the royal family all over Europe. And he is the sort of original Madame Tussaud, actually. But he was accorded this great social status, which is something that we don't think of when we think about an impermanent material like wax. We think of more of wax as being something you see in a sideshow, not something you see in an art gallery. But that was not always the case. Certainly in the 17th century, this was considered art. There's no question. Into the 18th century, I think something new happens. And that is that the realism of sculpture, or the potential realism of sculpture, is enlisted not for devotional reasons, not necessarily for exclusively commemorative reasons, but for a kind of empiricism, a kind of scientific realism that is fascinated with depicting the thingness, for want of a better term, of a living individual. And an artist like Augustin Pajou here, I think, is doing precisely that. This is a friend of his. He's not a nobleman. He's not a prince. He's not a cardinal. He's no one terribly important that you wouldn't think would warrant a portrait bust, because portrait busts are usually of princes and kings and the rest of it. This is just a friend of his. It's almost like a study that Pajou does of his friend, depicted with this extraordinary alive facial expression, and unusually with his mouth open, showing his teeth, which were not, on the whole, a particularly attractive element in the pre sort of daintily conscious 19th and 20th centuries. It's done in terracotta, which of course is not a new medium, but when you think about the way in which terracotta is made, it's an additive process. You add the clay to build up the figure, as opposed to marble cutting, where you cut away the bits that you don't want. So it's a very organic and immediate type of sculptural technique, which allows this kind of realism to be achieved. And then there's one extraordinary sculpture from the 18th century, which I just want to talk about briefly, and that is this marble sculpture of the great French philosopher Voltaire. Now, you might be familiar with Houdon, another French sculptor of this period, who did a famous portrait of Voltaire seated, looking like a sort of Roman philosopher. Well, this one shows him, warts and all, as an emaciated old man, which is what he was in 1774, when the original sculpture was begun. And it was commissioned to celebrate this kind of icon of the Enlightenment, the man who defended individuals against religious intolerance, the man who believed that the individual's rights to free expression were fundamental to the human condition, something that was a very new and radical idea at the time. Voltaire agreed to be portrayed by the sculptor Pigalle, although he didn't know that this is how Pigalle was going to represent him. And Pigalle went to Ferney, which is near the border with Switzerland, where Voltaire was in retirement, and did a series of drawings. Money that was raised to pay for the sculpture was by subscription. So it wasn't a state commission. It wasn't a single individual patron commissioning the work, but it was by subscription to people who belonged to what they rather quaintly referred to as the Republic of Letters. Anyone who belonged to this rather loosely defined group who believed in the kinds of freedom of thought, freedom of expression, that Voltaire espoused. But it all backfired when Pigalle presented the sculpture to the subscribers. They were horrified, absolutely horrified, that their great hero was depicted as an emaciated old man with no clothes on. This was not Voltaire depicted as a heroic nude. This was Voltaire naked. And that was a very big difference in 18th century aesthetic theory. They went to Voltaire to kind of get his agreement to have the sculpture destroyed. And Voltaire said, no, no, no. I may not like it, but I respect the artist's individual right to depict me as he has done. Thereby demonstrating the very notion of individual expression that had driven the commission in the first place. And it explains the extraordinary realism of the depiction. There he is, smiling. And I really think that this is the 18th century antecedent to Dead Dad. You know, this is a figure content with its own physical limitations, with his own imminent death, with his own mortality.
Did they give their money back?
No. Catherine of Russia was particularly upset. Now, into the 19th century, how am I doing for time? into the 19th century, what we do find is the scientific, what I've called the scientific realism of the 18th century, taken to its ultimate extreme in proto-ethnographic sculpture generated by the voyages of discovery. Dumont d'Urville came to New Zealand in the 1830s, and on board the ship was a French phrenologist and artist, Alexandre Dumoutier, who did casts, life casts, of Maori individuals, which he then hand-painted or coloured back in France. And there's a whole set of these not in the Louvre, they're in the Museum of Mankind. So there is now a division, a split, between art and ethnography. Okay? And this is, it's a sense of unease that a cast does not have sufficient artistic input to be considered art. Well, of course, it's a wonderful object. And if you go upstairs to the permanent collection, you'll see Fiona Partington's fabulous re-photographings of these heads in the first room of Brought to Light. This unease about this casting from life is perfectly expressed in the controversy that raged when Rodin exhibited this work, The Age of Bronze, at the Paris Salon of 1877, where he was accused of exhibiting a cast done from an actual human being. And a tribunal was established to investigate this accusation. They met, they deliberated, they talked to the artist, and they came to the conclusion that it wasn't a life cast, that the artist hadn't, in fact, cheated, in their terms, but that it looked too much like a life cast. So he was kind of still in the negative. Instead of realizing his extraordinary ability to render the human form, he was criticized for not being idealized enough. And perhaps this painting kind of sums up that sense of unease. Not a very well-known artist, Edouard Danton, from about the period of the Rodin, slightly later, of this very nubile young woman having the cast that has been done from her by these two men removed, and she's striking this very come-hither type pose, representing, I think, the sort of 19th century unease or disquiet about what really goes on in a studio, and, you know, the life cast, of course, just being a bit too close for comfort. Well, that brings me, of course, to Madame Tussaud, who is the figure that we most associate with wax wax sculptures. She, of course, was daughter-in-law, I think, of the man who started a waxworks museum or a sideshow in Paris, where he exhibited wax dummies of the royal family prior to the French Revolution. And she then took over the business and went to England about 1800, just after the French Revolution, just after the Terror, where, of course, the British were completely fascinated and repulsed by the horrific act that had been perpetrated on the aristocrats in revolutionary France. And she created this mythology around herself that she had, in fact, been present at the guillotinings of these aristocrats, had gone to the mass grave where their bodies were interred, and had taken the heads and moulded the heads from life, taken wax casts from the heads of people like Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI. It simply isn't true. She didn't do that, but she created this mythology. And that mythology is continued today in the present display of Madame Tussaud's so-called Chamber of Horrors in London. Here she is, supposedly, with her lamp at the cemetery near the Church of La Madeleine, where the decapitated bodies have been thrown into a mass grave. And here we have quite a recent display, actually. This is about the third or fourth emanation of the severed heads of revolutionary victims at Madame Tussaud's. Now, apparently, a decapitated head does not bleed, certainly not from the nose. These have been, made to look more horrific by the artists. Her most famous and popular exhibits was Horatio Nelson. And this is the current Horatio Nelson, but it's in fact based on the moulds that Madame Tussaud did make, not from his face, but the moulds that she actually made of her version of his portrait, and it's still being used for modern moulds of figures like this. And I couldn't help but throw this one in. It never ceases to amaze me how easy it seems to be to get into Madame Tussaud's. But there we are. I want to finish with this because it seems to me that, I've given this kind of story of a trajectory into which Muick's art fits or has some kind of dialogue with. And, of course, the artist who really did kind of take the waxwork sideshow back into the art gallery was Dwayne Hanson, from the 1970s, a sort of late pop artist who represented, not the beautiful, not the Angelina Jolies, but the ordinary folk, in this case the tourists, and creating a kind of, or feeding into, I suppose, a kind of quintessentially romanticized view of the ghastly American tourist. To some extent, he creates it as well. And these sculptures, of course, were being produced in really from the late 60s, 70s. There's one in Adelaide, which Muick actually saw. She's looking worse for wear now. But this is what happens, is that tradition of realist waxwork sculpture comes back into the art gallery, but with an obvious kind of self-aware, self-critical, self-questioning view. So I think I'll stop there, and I hope you might have some questions.
Similar tradition, I thought you might have shown some pictures of them, of the wax images of the monarchy, of the monarchs of England, which are kept in Westminster Abbey, mm-hmm. and these to be repeated each year, make procession down the street, so that would be an important part of this topic.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole history of portraiture and wax is a whole other picture, really. But yes, you're absolutely right, and the same is true in Spain, and Vienna has said as well. And of course, the whole history of votive sculpture too. People giving, an image of themselves to a saint, or it might be a hand or a leg or an arm, in thankfulness for, being cured of something. That's another side of things that would go.
If you had a picture of Stalin or Lenin, it already existed, it'd be a kind of convergence.
Absolutely.
But you couldn't find one.
I couldn't, no. Well, so many of them have been destroyed. Right? So many of them have been destroyed.
Would they like them?
Yeah.
For the terracotta, how long did the artist have to work with it before it all set?
Oh, quite a while. They could simply keep wetting it to, you know, so that it continued to be malleable. There's another thing I didn't talk about too, and that's the whole kind of lost wax process of bronze casting, which in fact depends on the fragility of wax to happen. You know, you create a mould, you then put the wax around it, and then you pour the bronze into the space where the wax is, and the wax is melted away, and the bronze remains. So something as permanent as bronze, in fact, relies on something as impermanent as wax to do its job, to come into reality.
I talked with a number of friends after we'd seen it, and this, of course, is an art debate, so your talk was a really good corrective to the tendency to dismiss it. But some of us had a kind of an immediate strong reaction which didn't last as long as some more obviously artistic works. Do you have any comments?
Well, I, there's no question it's art. You know, he's an artist. He operates within the whole infrastructure of the art world. Now, whether you agree that makes it art or not, I think is the question. I mean, you could say the same of Mark Quinn or Jeff Koons, I suppose. You know, but all three do engage with a kind of populist aesthetic. You know, I mean, there's no question that Muick sculptures are incredibly popular, that they elicit a very immediate response, which may not involve, probably doesn't involve any kind of, you know, grand intellectualizing. But, you know.
I mean, you mentioned the the lack of colour now on the Terracotta Lamentation group, and also the less than wonderful preservation of the Duane Hanson in Adelaide. I mean, which, you know, the Lamentation even now is powerful. I'm just sort of wondering what Ron Muick's work
looked like in 30 years.
Look like in the future. I mean, how will they wither?
Well, Dead Dad is, what, how old now? 97, 10, 13 years old, 14 years old. He's still looking all right.
What about the concept of size? A lot of the work that you've played with there are of similar life size.
Yes.
But the thing about Muick's work is there's such extraordinary range of size.
And that is absolutely the major difference between anything I've shown tonight and Muick, is that he deliberately plays with scale. And I was really struck today in the exhibition of the way in which the majority, I won't say everyone, but the majority of people migrated towards the smaller ones. In particular, that extraordinary image of the woman lying in the bed at the end of the exhibition. Now, as someone who has a mother who's dying in a nursing home at the moment, that image just kind of hits you, you know, despite its scale, or perhaps because of its scale. Because of the size, you want to pick it up. You want to nurse it. You want to, you know.
With the wax medium, I presume there's a lot of filler in those wax. Do you know what sort of mixtures?
Wood and metal, like sort of like a mat. They make a mannequin.
I was thinking more of the actual moulding medium. The wax would be mixed with plaster or whatever.
Yes. I'm not an expert in the technique.
Yeah, to avoid melting and all the other problems and being soft and dripping slightly.
There are recipes, actually. Certainly, when I was reading about those 17th century Spanish artists, there were recipes for how you made different parts of the body, and you used a different viscosity of wax for the head than you did for the limbs. Yeah, so they clearly were aware of the need to have different materials.
Reading William Dalrymple recently, who's got some very interesting comments. He uses it in a chapter of a book of essays to largely denigrate, but he spoke with Millick at that exhibition when Dead Dad first appeared, and indeed it is his father.
Oh,
are the others, he actually, Dalrymple says, argued, is this respect, honouring the dead, or indeed disrespect, depicting one's dead father in such a way? But you may comment on that. My question is, are the other sculptures, there was his own face, and all the others are based on actual people?
Mask is certainly a self-portrait. I think the man in the boat may be based on...
Pregnant woman is
definitely a real model. He does use models, certainly.
Woman in bed.
Woman in bed. This is why. Yeah.
And the old woman then, or the old couple of women.
I don't.
Oh, Drift, the man of a woman.
Drift, that's.
Is just based on a friend.
Yeah. But what about the two women?
I don't know.
The two of the old women.
Chuck is a Mexican chuck.
I don't know about you, but I know that the 100,000th visitor was particularly taken by the chicken. But I don't know about you, but I saw a lot less people looking at the chicken than at the people. Would that be fair enough?
Well, of course, Girl is his own daughter as well. The baby is his own daughter. Question over there.
Oh, thank you. You've been a great audience. Lovely.